what does the U.S. midterm election result mean for international relations, ethical consideration of U.S. border policy, and the future of U.S.-Russia relations. Guest host Doug Becker speaks with three experts. Doug is professor of international relations at USC, and here's that discussion.
You're listening to the Scholar Circle. I'm Doug Becker, and we're looking at what the U.S. midterm election results mean to international issues, ranging from issues of environmental protection to the question of violence on the border to broadly the U.S. relationship with institutions like the United Nations. Joining us for this segment are Pam Chasek, who's the chair of the Political Science Department at Manhattan College. She's the author of Transforming Multilateral Diplomacy, the Insight Story of the Sustainable Development Goals, as well as Global Environmental Politics and the Global Environment in the 21st Century, Prospects for International Cooperation. Amy Eckert, who is professor of political science at the Metropolitan State University of Denver. She's the author of Outsourcing War, the Just War Tradition in the Age of Military Privatization, and a book chapter entitled Critical Approaches to the Ethics of War. And Brent Sasley, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Texas at Arlington. He's the co-author of Politics in Israel, Governing a Complex Society, and author of an article, Palestinian Roadblocks, Changing Attitudes Among Israeli Jews. So let me start in general, just to get your thoughts about the impact that any sort of international issues may have from the midterms, with a quick reminder, as we all know, and to remind the listeners, that foreign policy really is the purvey of the executive branch. So ultimately, how much control and how much influence Congress can have constitutionally as well as practically is somewhat limited. But I do think there are some distinct implications. So, Pam, let's start with you. What do you think are some of the most important takeaways from the election?
For the environment?
A policy in general.
For foreign policy in general. Sadly, not much. I think that while Democrats did take the House, that many people will see the fact that the Republicans maintain control over the Senate, which tends to have a stronger role in U.S. foreign policy than the House does anyway, because the Senate is responsible for the ratification of treaties. And so with Donald Trump still in the White House and the Senate still controlled by Republicans, there may be a bit of an oversight check by on the part of the House, but I don't think it's going to make a big difference. I'll be interested to hear what the others think.
Amy, what do you think?
I would tend to agree with Pam in the sense that we're unlikely to see significant changes in the executive branch. And, you know, obviously we've been seeing a lot of foreign policy issues and problems coming out of the executive branch, the diplomacy, the reversals where we're kind of pushing away traditional allies and embracing, you know, authoritarian regimes around the world. And, you know, even in terms of what's happening at the State Department, we've got a State Department that is woefully understaffed. We've got 40 vacant ambassador positions still 2 years into the Trump regime, you know, including countries like Turkey, Saudi Arabia, our major allies, Mexico, Australia, have no ambassadors to represent the U.S. in those countries. In addition, we have a huge number of civil service positions that are also empty. Even at the assistant secretary level, we've got about a third of the assistant secretary positions that are still vacant 2 years into the Trump administration. So, you know, part of this is kind of a shift in emphasis away from diplomacy to an emphasis on Department of Defense, a more militarized foreign policy. But, you know, if we're looking at what could change or really the role that the House could assume if it chooses, you know, Democratic control of the House means that we're going to have Democrats chairing committees like foreign affairs, like intelligence. And what this means is that they can utilize the congressional power to investigate, and they can compel testimony, they can compel production of documents through subpoenas, and, you know, perhaps bring some accountability to a body that, you know, up until the midterm elections had by and large been kind of a rubber stamp for the administration in terms of its foreign policy. Long shot, we could see some legislation, but that's going to require, you know, some defection in the Senate on the part of Republicans, which probably not all that likely.
Yes, I echo that concern. And the House can't force the president to actually nominate ambassadors, so that's always obviously.
Yeah, unfortunately, they can't. So, I mean, it's unlikely that we're going to see those positions being fully staffed. And, you know, I mean, there are just some obstacles in the executive branch that kind of stand in the way in terms of, you know, Trump not wanting to appoint, you know, certainly Democrats and also even Republicans who've been critical of his foreign policy. So he's got kind of this list, if you will, and just kind of generally the shift away from diplomacy toward a more militarized foreign policy.
Brent, your thoughts?
I agree with Pam and Amy. The system isn't set up for the House to have all that much of a say in foreign policy, although I would add that there are two potential areas or spheres which the shift to a Democratic House might have an effect, and one is kind of intangible, and that one is I think that foreign leaders, or certainly at least American allies, are looking at, they might take hope from the election, to put it that way. I think that they're very, certainly after 2 years, they've become not just uncertain about the Trump administration and therefore American foreign policy, but unhappy. And they're looking for something that they might be able to latch onto that gives them a sense that things might go back to the way they were, or that there is some check on the Trump administration in the government or in the American system, and then that might make them, it might have an influence, or it might shape some of the ways that they approach some of the foreign policy issues that they've been dealing with, including around getting around the United States. And then the second area is what Amy mentioned. I think if the Democratic-controlled committees do begin a series of investigations, which so far they seem to indicate they will, that could well distract the Trump administration from doing a whole bunch of other things related to foreign policy, and therefore their attention wouldn't be on a whole range of issues from climate change to North Korea to the Middle East. And then that, it's unclear if that would be good or bad, but that could well be an effect.
Hey, you mentioned climate change, so this is a great opening for Pam. I know a great deal of the first 2 years of the Trump administration has been rolling back, not obviously walking away from the Paris Accords was a symbolic move, but where so much of the action has taken place has been an executive action, reversing a number of executive actions by the Obama administration, some of which tied to Paris, but you know, really ranging across numerous issue areas. Are there any issue areas, Pam, that you can see maybe where some of this reversal might be reversed, and that we might return back to some of the previous protections?
You know, it's possible that we'll start to see some movement in the House. According to the League of Conservation Voters, 46 new quote-unquote pro-environment representatives were elected to the House, is what they're claiming, that we're going to have a new chairwoman of the House Science Committee, who actually believes in science, Eddie Bernice Johnson. This is the House Committee on Science, Space, and Technology. We will also have other chairs of committees in the House who tend to be more pro-environment and more concerned about climate change. But the problem is we're not going to see that on the Senate side, and we're certainly not going to see that on the White House side. And if these elections showed us anything, that a number of environmental initiatives did not pass in these elections, state initiatives, and largely because oil, gas, and coal companies, fossil fuel companies, basically poured millions and millions of dollars into these states to defeat the initiatives. And my sense is that money is still going to be pouring into the coffers of those who want to, you know, those who would vote against any clean energy conservation or climate change legislation that might emerge from the House, but will probably be dead on arrival in the Senate and would definitely not make it through to the White House unless there's some trade-off that I just don't see happening right now.
Maybe the most important thing that a Democratic House provides is a forum by which Democrats can present a platform that they intend to run in 2020. And so could we see legislation making its way through the House, likely dying in the Senate, but kind of symbolic legislation?
Probably. But it's not, you know, it may be symbolic, but it's really not going to help us achieve, you know, global climate change or global warming of less than 2 degrees centigrade. Symbolism, unfortunately, will not be effective. Most of the action that we're likely to see is going to be on the state level, which is where we've seen most of the action. But I try very hard to be optimistic, but I don't see the states being able to do as much as that is necessary without support and legislation at the federal level. Mm. So we've got a number of new governors who are elected who may be likely to incur, and new state houses that are now controlled by Democrats. But we have to remember that being a Democrat does not make you an automatic environmentalist and does not make you automatically concerned about climate change. And we tend to conflate that at times.
Yeah, Joe Manchin certainly comes to mind in the coal industry
exactly.
in West Virginia. Now, Amy, I know you do quite a bit of work on ethics and the use of force. I'm going to turn to you and ask, you know, some of the most newsworthy developments over the first 2 years of the Trump administration took place right there on the border. And with so much of the emphasis being on immigration, on the caravan, and raising some ethical issues about the use of the military along the border, do you think there's going to be any sort of change in that profile? I know a lot of it has to do with politics of, you know, declaring that, for instance, the military will, you know, they'll shoot at anybody who's throwing a rock. But what sort of implications for the ethics of the use of force, for instance, along the border, does the success that the Democrats have had, if any?
Oh, that's a great question. In theory, this is an area that's subject to congressional control, right? The Constitution gives Congress the authority to declare war, not the executive branch. However, what we've seen, you know, for a number of decades is the executive branch kind of assuming kind of ever-growing authority over the use of force. And certainly, I think this administration obviously is not an exception. And here, you know, in this particular instance where we're sending troops to the border to deal with this caravan of immigrants, you know, we're not actually sending them out of the country, right? They're patrolling the border. And, you know, the reality is that, you know, Customs and Border Patrol, you know, the military kind of have extensive jurisdiction within the territory of the U.S. That said, specifically, you know, the issue of, for instance, shooting rock throwers is kind of, you know, it's obviously very troublesome from an ethical perspective. The idea that we would be shooting someone who's armed only with a rock is fairly horrifying. And, you know, what kind of encourages me on that point is we've seen pushback, actually sometimes quite publicly, from members of the military on this particular issue, stating that they're not, you know, going to shoot unarmed civilians or people who are throwing rocks, which is heartening, and, you know, very much consistent with the obligation that members of the military have to disobey orders that would be unlawful, and certainly firing on unarmed civilians would fall into that category.
Yeah, and what's always so disheartening to me isn't just what American policy, you know, would necessarily be. I mean, obviously, border issues and the impact on the people at the border, asylum seekers at the border, is pretty disheartening. But some of the stories coming out of more authoritarian regimes citing the lack of U.S. interest in enforcing these sorts of norms as well, giving a kind of carte blanche permission for regimes like, for instance, the story in Nigeria of the military citing firing on unarmed civilians throwing rocks and saying, well, obviously what we've done is justifiable based on statements made by the president. You're listening to The Scholar's Circle, and I am Doug Becker. And we're looking at what the U.S. midterm election results mean to U.S. foreign policy, ethical considerations of U.S. border policy, and the future of U.S.-Russian relations. Brent, I know a great deal of your research is on emotions in politics, and certainly these last 2 years, we've seen a number of pretty intensely emotional displays ranging from, you know, some of the historical memory on issues like Confederate statues to the symbolism, and I would argue probably more of an emotional symbolism than anything else, of moving the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem. Does this election address those issues at all, and where do you see the next 2 years going on some of these more emotional reactions in American politics?
Well, I'm not an Americanist, so I want to be careful what I say about voting patterns, but mm-hmm. It seems to me that there's a greater awareness of the value of, there always has been, any political campaign, you know, recognizes the value of appealing to one's emotions or a group's emotions and their fears and things that make them happy or sad. But it's pretty clear, so there's some debate about whether or not Trump's stumping for candidates and references to the xenophobia and the caravan and referencing all these things that plays really well to his base, based on fear of others or fear of social change brought on by including others, whether that was some kind of strategic calculation or whether that's just who he is, and that's just what he talks about, and he thinks that's appeals to both him and to the people close to him. But either way, it seems to me, and I can't quantify this, I haven't measured it yet, but it seems to me that that was much more explicit in the last couple of years, well, certainly in the presidential campaign, but then ever since then, as a way of making sure that people stay mobilized. And so it would be interesting to compare what Trump and those Republicans who adopted his kind of language, how well they fared or how useful it was for them compared to Democrats who may have used fear, but from the other end regarding all the bad things that would happen if the Republicans remain in office. I think it's becoming just a lot more clear, it's crystallizing for us just how important this has become. That might be just because the United States has become far more polarized over the years, over the decades, and maybe it just fits really well here. But I think we also have a sense that it's this fear of others has become more prevalent or more relevant to political campaigns around the world, as we've seen populist groups and individuals make these kinds of appeals. And in some cases, they do really well. In some cases, they win elections. But it seems to be working for people.
That's one of the more interesting takeaways, is whether or not appeals to race and whether or not appeals to fear and how effective that was. Because certainly in a number of Senate races, it seemed to play a pretty significant role. But it may not have played quite as well in some of the House races. But I think I think it's a reasonable expectation that that's a strategy that's likely to continue.
And the other thing I would add to that, you mentioned historical memory. That fear it's not just an emotional reaction, or it's not just trying to provoke an emotional reaction. The provocation of this emotional reaction is tied to a constructed historical memory of what the country used to, quote unquote, used to look like, by which they mean what we want it to look like. They're reading back what they want. They're reading back into history what they think the country looked like. And so in Europe, in Israel, in the United States, the appeal that they use to strike this fear into the hearts of voters is based on this constructed reality of what the country used to look like, what its identity was, what its values were. And all of those things were based on a very small or narrow community of citizens, the idea that everyone else who doesn't belong because they're different, that they might be taking over, they might be changing who we are and what we stand for and what our values are. That's where that fear is coming from.
Now, Pam, I know you are in New York and you do quite a bit of work with the UN. We're obviously going to have a new UN ambassador. What do you expect? This isn't necessarily the elections as much as it is the departure of Ambassador Haley, but what do you expect over the next 2 years of the U.S.'s relationship with the United Nations?
Probably not much different than it's been over the past 2 years. And when you look back, it really, with the exception of some of the inflammatory language, shall we say, that President Trump has used, generally speaking, the U.S. Voting record at the U.N. and the U.S. Actions at the U.N. have really not changed a lot over the past 2 years. The U.S. is still a staunch supporter of Israel at the U.N., one of the few that will always vote in favor of Israel, and that rarely changes from administration to administration. While the Trump administration is planning to withdraw from the Paris Accord as soon as the U.S. is able to, the U.S. is still participating in negotiations under the U.N. Framework Convention on Climate Change, just like it has participated in negotiations of numerous other treaties that the U.S. is not a party to. The U.S. always is at the table. With regard to the withdrawal from the Human Rights Council, which took place over the summer, that Nikki Haley announced because the Human Rights Council members are major human rights abusers, and the Human Rights Council has a standing item on Israel, but not a standing item on other human rights, on countries that the U.S. believes are human rights abusers. But the U.S. is still participating in, they haven't left the room. They're still there. They're still paying attention to what's going on. But that was more of making a political point which is not alone to Donald Trump. So while we hear a lot from him, so far it hasn't made that much of a difference. Now, a lot depends on who is going to be the next ambassador and whether that ambassador will, as Nikki Haley learned, feel the constraint of the position, that it doesn't give you a total open mic. She learned that pretty early. If you look at her speeches over the two-year period, they became a little more muted over time. You know, she sent a few little, you know, threw a few bones to Trump, but for the most part, after her warning that, you know, we'll be counting votes and things like that, she learned very quickly the value of diplomacy and how that works. So I'm not sure, you know, I've heard rumors, but nobody's been nominated yet, and I think a few trial balloons have been thrown out, but I don't know who's going to be the next ambassador, and a lot will depend on how quickly that person learns diplomacy or not.
And I think also another key variable here is that Nikki Haley, Ambassador Haley, had taken a pretty high profile for that position, I guess in large part because in some of the earlier days that she would strike a bit of a contrast with the president. And it seemed that she was able to walk a tightrope where she appeared sufficiently loyal that she certainly wasn't accused of not carrying out the president's foreign policy, you know, such as...
Well,
you know,
being in New York gives... cabinet members a certain degree of distance. Mm-hmm. They're not in Washington. They're not in that echo chamber. They're not in that highly politicized world inside the Beltway. When you're in New York, you're not being monitored all the time. You have a certain degree of freedom. And so as long as she gave the occasional speech that made it to the White House and made news, she could do a lot without overtly contradicting the administration, but at the same time not overtly supporting some of the rhetoric out of the administration. It's a benefit of being in New York and not in Washington, and that distance is really important. And she also is the first member of the administration to actually leave on her own terms.
I was going to add to that also, she seems to have shared some of Trump's views on Israel and Iran also, so that probably helped her maintain that distance even more.
Now, we have one elephant in the room, and I want to make sure that we don't finish this without discussing this, and that is U.S.-Russian relations. Certainly, the midterms give Democrats an opportunity to investigate, but also speculation about the special counsel or about Robert Mueller. I'll give all three of you an opportunity to respond to this. We'll start with Amy. What do you think about the future of U.S.-Russian relations and what often gets referred to as l'affaire russe?
That's a great question. Honestly, I'll be surprised if this is not one of the areas where the House Foreign Relations or possibly Intelligence Committees kind of choose to flex their investigatory muscle. In terms of the Mueller investigation, I mean, this is absolutely a delicate question. And we've seen, obviously Jeff Sessions now out being fired and replaced with an acting attorney general who has been in the past somewhat critical of the Mueller investigation. So I don't know. I mean, I think if Trump were to attempt to interfere with the investigation or to fire the special counsel, you know, I mean, I think that would be a provocation to which the House Democrats would have to respond in some way, whether it's whether it's using that investigatory power or attempting to kind of give the special counsel some kind of a stage if in fact he ends up being terminated by Trump.
Brent, do you have any thoughts?
I think that you asked about U.S. Russia relations, and I think that after the end of the Cold War, certainly in the early mid 90s or into the late 90s, there was a sense that things were getting so much better between the two countries and that there was there were still tensions and still areas where they disagreed or had opposite views or opposite positions, opposite interests on a series of issues. But there seemed to be some general sense that the world had turned over a new page regarding the two superpowers. And I think that attitude or that perception stuck with us stuck with America and to some extent stuck with people elsewhere in the world as well. But I'm not sure that it was that realistic to expect that that would continue, certainly after the end of the Yeltsin era, but even toward the end of his era when he was in power. And I think that, look, Russia just has a whole different set of interests, and their domestic politics plays out differently than it does in the United States, and it's not necessarily clear that things will get all that much better even when Putin eventually does leave the scene. There's no clear sense that whoever might replace him or whoever might come in the near future would make things very, very different. Even Barack Obama had trouble despite his interest in a reset. There was limits to what he could do, just based on what Russia was and what Russia wanted. And it doesn't seem like there's anything that would change at the domestic level in Russia to change that international calculus.
And Pam, do you have any thoughts?
I agree with what's been said already. I don't see, with the exception of oversight in the House, that there being a huge change because, as you noted in the beginning of this, that foreign policy is largely the purview of the executive branch. And also, we don't know what's really behind the Trump administration position on Russia. And we don't know what Mueller is coming out with. We can speculate, but we're not sure what, if anything, he's found at this point. We're not sure what business interests that the Trump organization may have with Russia and how that may be impacting our relations with Russia. So I don't think the elections are going, with the exception of oversight, going to change that relationship drastically at first. But once we find out, provided Mueller is protected and we do get results that give us a clearer picture, that then could have impact on things going forward.
The four of us all, as academics, are forced to speculate when we get asked about this, and we can try to speculate, but ultimately, I think the right answer is we need to wait and see. Wait and see what develops. I always like to say what makes politics so fascinating to me and what I try to pass on to my students is the way we view this as a great political drama. And we may be in a new chapter, but that chapter has just begun. So let me thank the three of you for joining us today in our conversations about the impact of the elections. Hopefully we can start seeing this start to crystallize a bit. And I'm sure, you know, in the same way the drama has just begun, the conversation has just taken a little bit of a different tone, a little bit of a different direction. And we're going to continue this conversation for the next 2 years. So thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd like to thank the panel, Pam Chasek, who's the chair of the Political Science Department at Manhattan College. She's the author of Transforming Multilateral Diplomacy, The Inside Story of the Sustainable Development Goals, and the Global Environment in the 21st Century, Prospects for International Cooperation. Amy Eckert, who is professor of political science at the Metropolitan State University of Denver. She's the author of Outsourcing War, The Just War Tradition in the Age of Military Privatization, and a book chapter entitled Critical Approaches to the Ethics of War. And Brent Sasley, associate professor of political science at the University of Texas at Arlington. He's the co-author of Politics in Israel, Governing a Complex Society, and author of an article, Palestinian Roadblocks, Changing Attitudes Among Israeli Jews.